Chapter 95. Mark. In 1903, preparations were going on for a great World's Fair to be held in St. Louis, and among other features proposed was a World's Literary Convention, with a week to be set apart in honor of Mark Twain, and a special Mark Twain Day in it, on which the National Association would hold grand services in honor of the distinguished missourian. A letter asking his consent to the plan brought the following reply. To T.F. Katz, of Missouri. New York, May 30, 1903. Dear Mr. Katz, it is indeed a high compliment which you offer me in naming an association after me, and in proposing the setting apart of a Mark Twain Day at the Great St. Louis Fair, but such compliments are not proper for the living, they are proper and safe for the dead only. I value the impulse which moves you to tender me these honors. I value it as highly as anyone can, and am grateful for it, but I should stand in a sort of terror of the honors themselves. So long as we remain alive, we are not safe from doing things which, however righteously and honorably intended, can wreck our repute and extinguish our friendships. I hope that no society will be named for me while I am still alive, for I might at some time or other do something which would cause its members to regret having done me that honor. After I shall have joined the dead, I shall follow the customs of those people and be guilty of no conduct that can wound any friend. But until that time shall come, I shall be a doubtful quantity like the rest of our race. Very truly yours, S. 50. Clemens. The National Mark Twain Association did not surrender easily. Mr. Katz wrote a second letter full of urgent appeal. If Mark Twain was tempted, we get no hint of it in his answer. To T.F. Katz, of Missouri. New York, June 8, 1903. Dear Mr. Katz, while I am deeply touched by the desire of my friends of Hannibal to confer these great honors upon me, I must still forbear to accept them. Spontaneous and unpremeditated honors, like those which came to me at Hannibal, Columbia, St. Louis, and at the village stations all down the line, are beyond all price, and are a treasure for life in the memory, for they are a free gift out of the heart and they come without solicitations. But I am a Missourian, and so I shrink from distinctions which have to be arranged beforehand, and with my privity, for I then became a party to my own exalting. I am humanly fond of honors that happen, but chary of those that come by canvas and intention. With sincere thanks to you and your associates for this high compliment which you have been minded to offer me, I am, very truly yours, S. 50. Clemens. We have seen in the letter to McAllister that Mark Twain's wife had been ordered to Italy and plans were in progress for an establishment there. By the end of June, Mrs. Clemens was able to leave Riverdale, and she made the journey to Quarry Farm, Elmira, where they would remain until October, the month planned for their sailing. The house in Hartford had been sold, and a house which, prior to Mrs. Clemens' breakdown, they had bought near Tarrytown, expecting to settle permanently on the Hudson, had been let. They were going to Europe for another indefinite period. At Quarry Farm, Mrs. Clemens continued to improve, and Clemens, once more able to work, occupied the study which Mrs. Crane had built for him 30 years before, and where Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn and the Wandering Prince had been called into being. To Rev. J. H. Twitchell, in Hartford, Connecticut. Quarry Farm, Elmira, NY, July 21, 03. Dear Joe, that love letter delighted Livy beyond any like utterance received by her these 30 years and more. I was going to answer it for her right away, and said so, but she reserved the privilege to herself. I judge she is accumulating hot stuff, as George Ade would say. Livy is coming along. Eats well, sleeps some, is mostly very gay, not very often depressed. Spends all day on the porch, sleeps there a part of the night, makes excursions in carriage and in wheelchair, and, in the matter of superintending everything and everybody, has resumed business at the old stand. Did you ever go house hunting 3,000 miles away? It costs 3 months of writing and telegraphing to pull off a success. We finished 3 or 4 days ago and took the Villa Popiniano.
Damn the name. I have to look at it a minute after writing it, and then a mall was in doubt
for a year by cable. 3 miles outside of Florence, under Fiesole, a darling location, and apparently a choice house, near Fisk. There's 7 in our gang. All women but me. It means trunks and things. But thanks be. Today this is private, comes a most handsome voluntary document with seals and escutcheons on it from the Italian ambassador, who is a stranger to me, commanding the customs people to keep their hands off the Clemens things. Now wasn't it lovely of him? And wasn't it lovely of me to let Livy take a pencil and edit my answer and knock a good third of it out? And that's a nice ship, the Irene. New Swift 13,000 tons, rooms up in the sky, open to sun and air and all that. I was desperately troubled for Livy about the down cellar cells in the ancient Atin. The cups are in Riverdale, yet they come to us the first week in August. With lots and lots of love to you all, Mark. The arrangement for the Villa Popiniano was not completed, after all, and through a good friend, George Gregory Smith, a resident of Florence, the Villa Quarto, an ancient home of royalty, on the hills west of Florence, was engaged. Smith wrote that it was a very beautiful place with a southeastern exposure, looking out toward Vallombrosa and the Chianti Hills. It had extensive grounds and stables, and the annual rental for it all was $2,000 a year. It seemed an ideal place, in prospect, and there was great hope that Mrs. Clemens would find her health once more in the Italian climate which she loved. Perhaps at this point, when Mark Twain is once more leaving America, we may offer 2 letters from strangers to him, letters of appreciation such as he was constantly receiving from those among the thousands to whom he had given happiness. The first is from Samuel Merwin, one day to become a popular novelist, then in the hour of his beginnings. To Mark Twain, from Samuel Merwin. Plainfield, NJ, August 4, 1903. Dear Mr. Clemens, for a good many years I have been struggling with the temptation to write you and thank you for the work you have done, and today I seem to be yielding. During the past 2 years I have been reading through a group of writers who seem to me to represent about the best we have: Sir Thomas Malory, Spencer, Shakespeare, Boswell, Carlyle, Lesage. And thinking over one and then another, and then all of them together, it was plain to see why they were great men and writers. Each brought to his time some new blood, new ideas, turned a new current into the stream. I suppose there have always been the careful, painstaking writers, the men who are always taken so seriously by their fellow craftsmen. It seems to be the unconventional man who is so rare, I mean the honestly unconventional man, who has to express himself in his own big way, because the conventional way isn't big enough, because he needs room and freedom. We have a group of the more or less conventional men now, men of dignity and literary position. But in spite of their influence, and of all the work they have done, there isn't one of them to whom one can give oneself up without reservation, not one whose ideas seem based on the deep foundation of all true philosophy, except Mark Twain. I hope this letter is not an impertinence. I have just been turning about, with my head full of Spencer and Shakespeare and Il Blas, looking for something in our own present-day literature to which I could surrender myself, as to those 5 gripping old writings. And nothing could I find until I took up I Found the Mississippi, and Huckleberry Finn, and, just now, the Connecticut Yankee. It isn't the first time I have read any of these 3, and it's because I know it won't be the last, because these books are the only ones written in my lifetime that claim my unreserved interest and admiration, and, above all, my feelings, that I felt I had to write this letter.
I like to think that Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn will be looked upon, 50 or 100 years from now, as the picture of buoyant, dramatic, human American life. I feel, deep in my own heart, pretty sure that they will be. They won't be looked on then as the work of a humorist any more than we think of Shakespeare as a humorist now. I don't mean by this to set up a comparison between Mark Twain and Shakespeare. I don't feel competent to do it, and I'm not at all sure that it could be done until Mark Twain's work shall have its fair share of historical perspective. But Shakespeare was a humorist, and so, thank heaven, is Mark Twain. And Shakespeare plunged deep into the deep, sad things of life. And so, in a different way, but in a way that has more than once brought tears to my eyes, has Mark Twain. But after all, it isn't because of any resemblance for anything that was ever before written that Mark Twain's books strike in so deep. It's rather because they've brought something really new into our literature, new, yet old as Adam and Eve and the apple. And this achievement, the achievement of putting something into literature that was not there before, is, I should think, the most that any writer can ever hope to do. It is the one mark of distinction between the onesome little group of big men and the vast herd of medium and small ones. Anyhow, this much I am sure of, to the young man who hopes, however feebly, to accomplish a little something, someday, as a writer, the one inspiring example of our time is Mark Twain. Very truly yours, Samuel Merwin. Mark Twain once said he could live a month on a good compliment, and from his reply, we may believe this one to belong in that class. To Samuel Merwin, in Plainfield, N.J. : August 16, 03. Dear Mr. Merwin, what you have said has given me deep pleasure. Indeed, I think no words could be said that could give me more. Very sincerely yours, S50. Clemens. The next compliment is from one who remains unknown, for she failed to sign her name in full. But it is a lovely letter, and loses nothing by the fact that the writer of it was willing to remain in obscurity. To Mark Twain, from Margaret M. : Portland, Oregon, August 18, 1903. My dear, dear Mark Twain, may a little girl write and tell you how dearly she loves and admires your writings? Well, I do, and I want to tell you your counsel. Don't think me too impertinent, for indeed I don't mean to be that. I have read everything of yours that I could get, and parts that touch me, I have read over and over again. They seem such dear friends to me, so like real live human beings talking and laughing, working, and suffering too. One cannot but feel that it is your own life and experience that you have painted. So do not wonder that you seem a dear friend to me who has never even seen you. I often think of you as such in my own thoughts. I wonder if you will laugh when I tell you I have made a hero of you? For when people seem very sordid, and mean and stupid, and it seems as if everybody was, then the thought will come like a little crumb of comfort, hell, Mark Twain isn't anyway. And it does really brighten me up. You see, I have gotten an idea that you are a great bright spirit of kindness and tenderness. One who can twist everybody's, even your own dash faults, and absurdities into hearty laughs. Even the person mocked must laugh. Oh dear! How often you have made me laugh! And yet as often you have struck something infinite away down deep in my heart, so that I want to cry while half laughing. So this all means that I want to thank you, and to tell you, I'd always love Mark Twain, is often my wish. I dearly love to read books, and I never tire of reading yours. They always have a charm for me. Goodbye. I am afraid I have not expressed what I feel. But at least I have tried. Sincerely yours. Margaret M. Clemens and family left Elmira October the 5th for New York City. They remained at the Hotel Grosvenor until their sailing date, October 24th. A few days earlier, Mr. Frank Doubleday sent a volume of Kipling's poems and De Blowitz's memoirs for entertainment on the ship. Mark Twain's acknowledgement follows. To F.N. Doubleday, in New York.
The Grosvenor, October 12, 03. Dear Doubleday, the books came ever so many thanks. I have been reading E. Bell Bowie and The Old Man over and over again, my custom with Kipling's work and saving up the rest for other leisurely and luxurious meals. E. Bell Bowie is a deeply impressive fellow being. In his many recent trips up and down the Sound in the canal at Mr. Rogers' yacht, he has talked to me nightly, sometimes in his pathetic and melancholy way, sometimes with his strenuous and urgent note, and I got his meaning, now I have his words. No one but Kipling could do this strong and vivid thing. Someday I hope to hear the poem chanted or sung with the bell buoy breaking in, out of the distance. The Old Man, delicious, isn't it? And so comically true. I haven't arrived there yet, but I suppose I am on the way. Yours ever, Mark. P.S. Your letter has arrived. It makes me proud and glad what Kipling says. I hope fate will fetch him to Florence while we are there. I would rather see him than any other man. We've let the Tarrytown house for a year. Man, you would never have believed a person could let a house in these times. That one's for sale, the Hartford one is sold. When we buy again, may I be damned. I've dipped in two boats, and find him quaintly and curiously interesting. I think he tells the straight truth too. I knew him a little, 23 years ago. The appreciative word which Kipling had sent Doubleday was : I love to think of the great and godlike Clemens. He is the biggest man you have on your side of the water by a damn sight, and don't you forget it. Servants was a relation of his. XLIII, Letters of 1904. To various persons. Life and Villa Quarto. Death of Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.